This is GamesAtWork.biz with Phaedra Boinodiris, Michael Martin, and Michael Rowe, your weekly podcast about gaming technology and play. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone, and not the opinions of any organization which we have been, are, or may be affiliated with.
This is episode 126, Reconfigure.
Good morning, good evening, good afternoon. Michael Rowe here on another exciting episode of GamesAtWork.biz with our special guest today, Ian Hughes, a.k.a. E-Predator, the author of a brand new techno thriller called Reconfigured. And we're going to talk a little bit about technology, the book, some of the gaming concepts behind it, etc. And also Ian Hughes, longtime friend of the show and colleague over the years. Ian, welcome to GamesAtWork.biz.
Thank you very much. That's my best intro ever. Thank you very much.
At least on this episode.
At least on this episode. It's onwards and upwards, isn't it?
Thank you very much. Or we can actually go really far, really down very quick. It's just the two of us this week. Unfortunately, our co-hosts, Michael Martin is traveling in Europe. So he's probably somewhere in your time zone right now.
He may be watching the fireworks somewhere near me. Yes.
Yes. And Phaedra is also traveling, so it's just the two of us. So, Ian, again, welcome. It is great to have you on the show.
It's awesome to be here. Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, my pleasure. And I will put a disclaimer in this episode. You gave me the opportunity to pre-read the book, and I really, really enjoyed it. And
thank you.
So. I was able to leverage that as a means to get you hooked to come onto the show. So tell us a little bit about, the high level story. Don't go too detailed. No spoilers.
No, I'm not going to do spoilers.
A little bit about the book, and then we'll kind of go through some more of the discussion. What's it about?
Reconfigure is about a young techie called Roisin Kincaid. She has a really busy evening one night, as all us techies do. I'd like to point out, I'm not Roisin Kincaid, despite everyone thinking I am. But we share some similarities, write what you know. And one night she accidentally does something that everyone has done, and I mean everyone, which is type the wrong thing into the wrong window.
Oh, yes.
We've all done it. And she happens to type in she's a techie, so she types in a Linux command into a tweet and manages to tweet the whole world. And she gets a lot of ridicule back, as one would. If you do something silly publicly, everyone dives on you. Everyone's a troll if they really try hard enough. But she accidentally realized she gets a response back and connects with something else. This other remote device machine person. She's not really quite sure what it is. But one way or another, it turns out that she's able, in interacting with this, to be able to act in a way that we would in virtual worlds, in the way that we move things around and we shuffle things around and we combine things and we do stuff, but she's actually able to do that in the physical world. So she has a bit of a journey of discovery to understand what these new powers, for want of a better word, are. But in using them, also finds that there's a nasty, shadowy organization that would really rather she didn't have those powers that come after her.
So as is wont to do.
Absolutely. So, so there's a bit of on corporate cartels, horrible type references in there. But most of it, after she's got past this exploration, becomes, as you very kindly called it, a thriller. So it's got some adventure elements of her trying to deal with this stuff. And she tries to use, because she's a gamer as well as a programmer, her mindset about how you experiment with things and how you tweak things and how you do things in kind of free roaming adventure games kind of comes out, because she tries some quite unusual ways to do this rather than the more obvious way. So she's quite often trying to score herself style points for how she deals with situations with this particular set of techniques that she has available. So So yes, and it leads into it. It then gets weird.
Well, you know, we will not get into spoilers here.
No spoilers.
But I will say I was. It was really interesting, you know, you and I worked together years ago, and we've, you know, kept in contact doing things over the years, looking at new cool tech, looking at gaming technology, et cetera. And it was so refreshing to see how a lot of that, at least in my opinion, of that discovery, of that exploration is exposed through the story. Not like, directly, but the kind of the concepts, right? So how does one go about learning new technology? How does one expose themselves to this? How do you do the discovery? And as you said, the gamer mentality of exploring a new space.
Absolutely. And that was, say, right what you know. It's the first time I've tried to put something like that together, but I wanted to, there's several kind of themes that explore that, and precisely what you said there, which is the how it feels to do what we do and how it feels to solve some of the problems we solve in games or solve some of the ways we go about developing software. And different people do it in different ways, but it is applying that gamer mentality to situations and the willingness to just kind of dabble and try and experiment and combine and see what happens. And then take that a little bit further with a bit of mastery once you get that, and to feel that you're kind of moving forwards in some way and with a bit of finesse, not just doing everything by the numbers. That was part of it. And also some of it was when I've written some articles before in various kind of magazines and things, they've been about the future, but they're also about where we are at the moment. But I always try and inject some of the past in. And to show the correlation between what was happening 10, 20 years ago even, and the things that some of us wanted to do but didn't have the tech to do it.
Right.
So we had to use the kind of old-fashioned analog stuff to edit films or edit audio and pull stuff together. And now it's much easier for us to do it, but you can see that generation now is able to kind of pick that stuff up. So those same desires to create, manipulate, and put things together, the tools are there. And so if they're educated or given the opportunity to see those tools there to reach that, then they can, there's going to be a whole generation creating wonderful things. So it was that kind of vibe I was trying to go for, not to be overly preachy about it, but just to say, yeah, you can do this stuff. You can pull some of this stuff together. Obviously the science fiction elements that then go off in the no spoiler territory are something else, but that's to kind of reward the bothering to stick with that creative process in the first place.
Well, it's interesting because my undergraduate degree, right, was a combination of programming as a minor and journalism as my major, working on television and radio production. So
yeah.
I learned the concepts of how you would edit together an auditory story.
Yeah,
and back in that day, we literally, and people might freak out about this, you would have tape, right? Yes. The auditory tape on these large reels, and you'd put them on a little metal block, and you would get a razor, and you
That's
would cut
one.
It, and you would slide it to another one, and you'd cut it, and you'd put them together, and you put a little piece of tape on the back of it, and that was how you literally spliced together a story. And
Absolutely.
Those same exact techniques, at least at the conceptual level, is how I edit today in Logic, right? Which is, you know, it's kind of an abstraction of those techniques.
It is, but I also find it interesting that those techniques of the digital become physical again. When we talked about, you know, I know you've got a 3D printer as well.
Yep.
That the taking the virtual and making it physical again becomes a weird part of that transition. So,
absolutely.
So you are splicing things together and putting things together and altering things, but then they become real solid things. So that, as you say, the analog nature of what we used to do, because I did the same with cinema films and kind of splicing and copying them together and sticking a bit of tape over the top and trying to make the sprocket lines line up. It's a very kind of physical activity, but you have to launch your head above that to think about which pieces of film am I trying to string together. And I know I did mine very badly, because I took my there was lots of pieces of cine film of me as a kid that because my dad had a cine camera. It was quite unusual for people to bother with them, and so there were five or six films that they're only 3 minutes long, but went from me being like three or four to me being 10 or something like that, and I spliced them together, and I had. It was the same thing. It was the razor blade and the tape over them. Yep. And then I played them and realized I'd actually spliced them in the wrong order. so it's, and I pretended it was art and I was actually showing me getting younger and, you know, traversing back into youth a bit. But it was just that straightforward, oh, it doesn't go around that way. Because once you've done it, when you edit like that, unless you've got, you know, lots of prints of things, you are reducing stuff, aren't you?
Yeah, it's destructive editing, right?
It's like it's aging, isn't it? And yeah. and as you lose strands of DNA and things, it's the same thing. So editing feels a dangerous pastime, whereas, as you know, kind of digitally, it's not. So it's quite difficult to get out of that mindset, isn't it, that of anything you change you might break it or lose the bit that you really need. But in digital, we have that ability to just bring it back if we mess it up.
So let's talk a little bit about the process of going from a developer, an evangelist of technology to an author, and how did that experience and those concepts that you learned help you or hinder you in actually putting this book together?
That's I wouldn't say it hindered, which
is
good.
That's good. That's good.
I didn't necessarily instantly approach it thinking it was a software project in that kind of I didn't say, right, I'm now going to do my architecture diagram and work out where things are and then pick the platform and all those sorts of things. But having now looked back, because it all happened quite quickly, having looked back on it, the processes I went through quite naturally that just kind of came out are do map one-to-one with what I would do if I was going to do a traditional or non-traditional software development. So there was kind of an overarching need to do it for a start. So there was a requirement.
Yep.
And I remember sitting there thinking that the core of it was, I was sat on holiday and I was just thinking about how weird it was when I manipulated something in Unity. There was a particular figure I had in Unity, and there was a character, and I just turned them over and flipped them upside down. And I wasn't supposed to be, because they were supposed to be kind of a rigged puppet, and the arm was supposed to stay where it was. And I was trying to do some martial arts moves with them, just kind of animation stuff. And they flipped right over, and I just thought, oh, that's, as we all have done it at various points, that's weird. What would it be like if you could do that in real life?
Yeah.
If you could freeze something and flip it. And so that was a requirement then, was how do I get that into something, in this case, a story or an article or a blog post, or I didn't quite know what it was. And then the book title appeared, so I had a handle to put on it. So it wasn't just flip weird character over in the blah. It just was, well, if I could reconfigure the world, what would I do? How would it work? So once I had that title, which happens in the book as well, when she gets a title for something, it gives you a focus.
Yeah.
So I had a requirement and I kind of had a code name, effectively, because that's often what happens in projects, isn't it? And I mulled it over and had a few more things, like the embarrassment of accidentally tweeting in the wrong place and doing stuff, because I think I probably did that at some point on holiday as well. And I came home, it was bank holiday and birthdays and stuff like that. And then the kids all had gone back to school. Breadlets were back at school. And I sat down with my whiteboard, which I hadn't wiped off anything for years. So that took quite a long while. Yeah. And I did a storyboard, but it kind of looked like a UML diagram. So there was some transitions between various states of confusion and discovery and peril. And it came out. Say that when I finished, as I was doing it, I thought, oh, that's an architecture diagram of some sort. So then it was, well, how do I break those down into various modules, which are obviously chapters,
right?
Maybe not obviously, but at the time it was like, well, that would form, are there enough words in that and enough things in that to make a decent unit of work? And then I just sat and I wrote, and so I spent 5 or 6 hours a day, just once the school run had happened, just coding effectively, so blatting out these words. Not really reading what I was writing, which was probably the mistake. but because then that meant there was a lot more testing need to happen afterwards. But as I was writing the main words, there was a substrate of technology in there, and some numbers and some coordinates and some distances and some things that I really wanted to make sure they added up. I hope they do, if anyone's mad enough to try and work it out. But so I had a separate board and separate set of stuff, which was kind of, I called it lore. It wasn't really quite lore, but where I double checked those facts. So I had the words and the routines effectively going round, but then I had the data that I was working on, and I wanted to make sure that the data was pure. So if I manipulated it through these procedures, which were my chapters, when they came out the other end to the next one, it still had to be right. Or transformed in the correct way. So it was software development in every single set. I was writing about software development as well in some parts of it, but it was. And then having done it, there then was the kind of unit testing of each kind of chapter, and does that make sense? And then the system test, and then the kind of user acceptance test, which you were very kindly part of. And that, you know, that's the scary bit of, well, I've written this system. Does it make sense to anyone?
Well, or it's interesting because, you know, one of the things I keep hearing, and you know, I listen to various different podcasts, including, I don't know if you know, Sword and Laser, which actually looks at, it's a book club, right? That does podcasts, and, you know, a couple of probably well-known podcasters out there that are the hosts, Veronica Belmont, which we actually had on Games, at Dog Ear Nation years ago, and Tom Merrick, who, they talk about when you're writing, you know, various different techniques, right? And I think about this when writing code and stuff too. Sometimes it helps just to sit down and just write. Don't worry about the flow. Don't worry about, you know, consistency, etc. And I find when I'm personally writing code, there are times when you get kind of into that zone where you're just writing. And back in the day, I would do that, and then my first test would be, does it compile? Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And it'd be like, I've been working for 6 hours and I forgot to compile in between. Yeah. And now I get, you know, 30 pages of errors.
Yep.
And you slowly peel it back and, okay, now it compiles. Does it do what I thought it would do? Oh, well, no, it reformatted my hard disk. I think I should start over. Right. And it's interesting to hear that same kind of a, you know, that approach of, I have a vision, right? Or a requirement. I've got an overarching storyboard, right? That says, how does it kind of have to fit together? Parsing it out into manageable chunks. And I was going to ask you, you know, I look at like the Game of Thrones books, right? Which every chapter is basically a TV scene, right?
Yeah.
Because George R. R. Martin, when he started writing, was actually a script writer. Not a fiction writer. And when you look at how the books are structured, they're very much structured as an individual scene from the perspective of one character.
Right.
Every chapter. And so you get scenes that are one page long, you get scenes that are, you know, or chapters that are one page long, et cetera. And the way you were describing it, it really kind of was like, I'm defining a method of a class.
Yes.
It needs to be encapsulated into something meaningful that has an entry and an exit that allows it to string together into the story. So
that's certainly, I mean, part of the, I didn't mention it before, part of the inspiration, I was on holiday and I read The Martian.
Oh, what did you think of that? Sorry.
And I loved it.
Well, same here.
So I was, you know, I got through it in, you know, 3 or 4 days of just constantly sat by the pool. It was, I'd go and do a few bit of martial arts in the sun and then a bit of swimming pool and then kind of sit and read The Martian. So it was to go from the nothingness of martial arts to the density of technology that is in The Martian. I was kind of back in the real world, even though it was on Mars. And I was struck by how how techy it was, and which is obviously the thing. And I didn't know that its history or anything. A few people had recommended it, and it was before the movie had hit. But I loved it, and I thought, oh, so you can write that much tech in stuff, and people are going to like it because I liked it, and he wrote that. So I thought if I went a bit overly techy about how something was built and stuff, then that, not to copy the Martian, but that was an acceptable form of using technology, not just here's a keyboard, tap-de-tap, magic happens, which is kind of the TV way you do technology, isn't it? So it as much as the image of the character flipping over, it was a catalyst for my brain at that time to go, well, I could give it a go, couldn't I, and see what happens. And gave how I wanted, how I thought I might write something, some legitimacy. So not to copy the mark, because it's fantastic. It's just an awesome book, obviously. But equally, as you mentioned TV stuff, as I was writing it, because it was so quick for me. I mean, it was 2 weeks of every day. I made it a job. So I just went at it. Each day, about 2 or 3 o'clock when I went off on the school run, I was in sort of a bit of a daze because I'd just done a chapter or a section that I kind of knew what was going to happen next, but didn't. So it felt like I was binge watching a box set. Right. So there were two of me doing it. There was the kind of techie part of me and the, you know, I'm constructing this and aware of what I'm doing. And then there was the flow version of me that was just doing it and being surprised by it. And that I think those things happen in code as well. You have that, I need to meet this requirement. Not quite sure I'm going to do it. Oh, look what I've done. and that's the joy of coding. And that's why I love tech. And that's why this felt like the same thing. The trouble is with words, whilst you have spell check, you don't have the equivalent of the compiler that you mentioned. You don't have anything to say. Everything you've just written there is complete drivel, or nobody likes it, or that won't work, or that doesn't fly. And I found that the proofreading piece is horrible. I mean, it was like 4 or 5 weeks, and obviously I had to get lots of other people involved in it, but I would reread things 20 times and still not see that all the words were backwards.
Yeah.
Because you're just so into it and trying to find that abstraction to be the I don't care what the words are. They need to be in the right order or the punctuation's correct. That was the hardest bit. But, and you know, it's probably, I've learned a lot about punctuation and writing as our co-friend Andy Piper will tell you, because he found a lot of commas that needed to go in.
Well, it's interesting. Years and years ago, I am like the worst proofreader of my own stuff. I think it's a thing that as a developer, we probably share, because you know mentally what you wrote.
Yeah.
What's on the paper is not what you wrote.
Yeah.
It's what's in your mind, and the paper, or in this case, I'm sure you used VI, right, to write this?
Yeah. Yeah. Of course.
No, maybe it was Edlin, you know, if you're in the DOS space. But
no, I hate command lines like that.
So a trick that I learned years and years ago to proofing your own work is to read it backwards.
Yes.
Right. And that was the most amazing thing, because your brain kind of snaps and you start reading what's actually on the paper.
That's
not
interesting.
What you knew you wrote.
I certainly started to try that, and it was driving me mad. but the other thing I did was, I was ironing my day box for Choi. So a lot of ironing in martial arts. And I just put the voice reader, the text-to-speech on.
Yeah.
And it was kind of infuriating because it couldn't say her name, Roisin, properly. And it couldn't say Techie, which obviously gets mentioned a lot. So there was Techie. And a few other ridiculous words. But there were times when I wasn't even really listening to her. I didn't think I was. Where I'd be ironing and just go, well, that's not right.
What the heck did I just
and,
say?
And, yeah, and you know, that would be some Yoda speak where the words were round the wrong way, and I'd go and check and like, oh, right. Oh, another correction. But so to try and find, I mixed trying to proofread it with printing out on paper in various sizes and putting it on the Kindle and all those things. But the thing was to get somebody else to do to read it, not to do it for you. But my wife Jan read the first kind of drafts of it when she got back from a very long trip to India, and she read it every day on the train going to London. And I'd get a couple of chapters back on a Kindle every day with my homework.
So I'm glad you mentioned The Martian, because I did kind of get a little bit of that vibe, because there was, you know, I really enjoyed The Martian also, and I haven't seen the movie yet, so don't spoil it.
Now I'm not going to. I think it may follow the book.
I think so,
but
too.
The trailer looked quite close.
but you know, the idea that you can take a fairly technical topic and turn it into something where the chapters and the story just constantly moves forward in a way that's not reading a technical manual, right? Was very enjoyable, and I think that's something that people who will read this book will enjoy, how that all comes together. So I know we've got about 10 minutes left, and what I'd like to see if you can hit on is, you know, what are some of the, when you think about you've got the process, you've got the story, you've just, you know, compiled and put it up on the web server, this thing, now what? Right?
Yeah.
So how does that process work?
It's one of, The same as you have with a website or an application or whatever. There's the release day or the release date or the time at which it goes live. And whilst you can change an ebook, a bit more difficult with the print one, but you can change it. You are kind of saying, well, I'm not changing anymore. I'm done. So there's an element of letting go, and the publishing it and hitting the publish button is as scary as the first ever tweet that you do, or the first ever blog post you do, or the first ever online interaction in an IRC chat or something. You think people are going to think I'm an idiot, and that's kind of a humbling experience itself. But so the book goes live, and then you look at the sales charts. And the trouble with digital stuff is that it tells you straight away what's happening. So when in the first 5 minutes you're not in the top 100, you start going, yeah,
you're
start
not.
Going, did I tell anyone about this? And so so obviously I've been on social media and stuff for years, but I've got my specific page on Feeding Edge, so my company has its own page. I got a specific URL for the book before I'd written it. I'd created a Facebook page. I tried to make sure everything was linked. So if you go on one page, you need to go to everywhere. So this whole kind of affiliate marketing thing for yourself is effectively what I was doing. And then I had to let people know. And as it went live, it didn't go live everywhere quite as quickly because it was rippling through Amazon. So I was telling people, here it is, because it was the UK one went live first because I'm on KUK. And then it took a few. It said it could take 48 hours or something, but it took about like an hour before it rippled on the other thing. So I thought, oh, no, I'm telling people. That's why they haven't bought it. I've told them, and they've gone, and it's not there. And then I just kept going on and on about it, which is sort of, it becomes an obsessive thing because you spend so much time doing this thing, and you want to share it with people, and you want them to enjoy it. And it's a difficult, especially in social media, it's a difficult line between sharing and badgering everyone to death. But then you think, well, that's what advertisers do anyway. So they're probably getting bombarded with adverts for all sorts of other things they don't want. So let's talk about it. So I then realized I probably needed to do, not just rely on kind of friends and family for this, but I needed to try real proper grown up advertising and, you know, cost per click type stuff. So I'd been experimenting with Google AdWords and with Amazon adverts and Facebook adverts and Twitter adverts without trying to spend too much money, because this isn't, you know, it's not a ridiculously expensive book that just brings loads and loads of money your way if it sells. So, but I needed to know how that worked. So it then became and has become a full-time job at some point each day to try and get on top of those adverts and see which ones are or aren't working and what other things I might be able to do to make some other people interested and get a bit of buzz or stuff about what's going on in the book. So I've done some really odd things. I did a little video about that, kind of a shorter version of what we've been talking about here, about the creative process and the thing that happened and some visualizations of what goes on in Unity when you flip these characters over just as something. I dragged my son in to do a funny little Vine video that kind of relates to what goes on in the book. I spent a few hours, more hours than I probably should, on Forza 6 on the Xbox, creating a reconfigure logo that I then stick on cars like the Lamborghini I've got. Cool. And so I then created a video of driving round in this sponsored car. But this car, which I've kind of talked about before when I've done things, but this car design can appear in other people's living rooms even if I'm not driving it.
Very cool.
If my driver tar in that game happens to pop up, it pops there. But obviously a car isn't something you can click on and go, what's that all about? But it's just an interesting thing for me to see, well, there's this other way of representing this kind of piece of prose that I've created. Also, I ended up with the paperback version of the book. So I went to, I was only going to do an ebook, and about a week in, I thought, oh, this create space thing exists. So how do I do all the technical bits to make this ebook become a print book? And, there was quite a few, going around the houses with that, but eventually kind of got there. And so, yeah, so it's, and joined Amazon authors. There's like Amazon Author Central, but there's a .com one and .uk one. So I had to fill all that stuff in. So it became the same that you do across all social media, but just more of it.
So now you have Reconfigure 1.1?
It's on its way. Yes. Or Reconfigure 2, I guess it is. So, yeah, it's codenamed Context at the moment with an E, a 3 rather than an E. And it is, it follows on from the end. So obviously I can't do spoilers.
Oh, no. But that's a good news. I was actually talking about the printed book would be 1.1.
Oh, I see. Oh, no,
but now that you've mentioned that there's a sequel coming, I think that should get a lot of people excited.
Well, I hope so. It's one of those, another one of those things in the whole marketing piece is that if you've written more than one book, then you sell more.
Yes. So,
well, not sell more, you get more readers. It's not really about selling things. So, but I left. There's some more to do with it, and I could have gone on and on and on, and there was no point doing a kind of Lord of the Rings.
Yes, you're not Neil Stevenson. It's not 1,200 pages long.
Exactly. Yes, I looked at some when I was doing the print book. I grabbed all the various kind of books that I've got that I like that I've got physical versions of. Just kind of flick through and see how they were laid out. And I don't know how I managed to read any of Neil Stevenson's ones because the print is so teeny now. So,
yes.
It's got so compressed. They're awesome, awesome books. But I just thought, that's not what I'm doing. So I've got these 350 page books. It's a nice size. It feels like a book. I've got a pile on my desk, which makes me feel happy every morning when I look at them. So I'm in the process of, I'm about 10,000 words into the new one. But having learned the process I went through, I'm going through the same process. I've got the storyboard. I'm writing the code, but I'm testing more often.
Excellent.
So whereas last time I went blah 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 system test, you know, the good old fashioned way. I'm now going blah blah blah. Next day unit tests.
Yes.
Adjust. And I'm also willing to go back when I'm a couple of chapters in. I'm willing to go back and change more. I was more worried before. It was that editing process that I said before about the physical editing feels like you're destroying, and you're not, because right. It's digital. If you mess it up, you can always get it back again. So, you know, word processors tend to, and, you know, I use Pages. They have every single thing you've ever done back to the year dot. So just have to go for it, really.
So you don't have it stored in a Git repo somewhere.
It's close. I stick it on Dropbox.
Yeah.
And I never overwrite the original one. So I've got every time I do a backup, it's like number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. just in case it's just not in case. Held inside the core of the Pages document. So it's like paranoia there.
well, Ian, what else is going on? We're just about out of time. What else is going on that people might want to follow you or hear about, or, you know, when's the movie coming out?
Well, I'd love to. Yes, the movie would be fantastic. Obviously I can't star in it because Roisin's a girl and someone younger than me, but that's what CGI is for, isn't it?
Yes. Hey, Arnold did another Terminator movie and was in two ages at the same time, so you can do it.
Very true. We can do that. At the moment, the thing that is going on is the follow up, really. So I've got this mix of doing the marketing bit on this, and then the mix of crafting a new one. And I very much more enjoy writing than I do selling. and that's been the same with all the tech that I do. I realized that the evangelizing has never been selling. It's creating those thoughts in other people's minds. And it's not, I need you to buy this product at all costs. It's never been that. So it's kind of my unfortunate personality type that I don't want to sell. I want to inspire, possibly. That sounds a bit grand, but I want people to go, oh, that's an interesting idea, or I hadn't thought of it that way. So this is me doing what I do, whatever that is. but now I can say, look, here's a book. So when people, it's like, oh, I don't know what you do. It's like, well, here's a lump of paper. Shut up.
Well, excellent. And for those who are interested, I know we'll have the link in the show notes, but what's the site that they can go to
reconfigurebook.co.uk is excellent. The main site, because everything links off that, and obviously the links to Amazon to buy the ebook, which is very reasonably priced, and the paperback, which is very reasonably priced, but it's £1.99, $2.99 for the ebook.
Excellent. And they can follow you on Twitter?
Absolutely. I'm at ePredator or ePredator on Twitter, ePredator. And say hi. I try and be very approachable. I'm not nasty. And I blog about all sorts of stuff and tweet about all sorts of stuff. So even if the past few weeks may have been slightly more focused on the book.
Imagine that.
just a little bit.
Well, Ian, as always, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on the show. I really enjoyed reading the book. I can't wait for 2.0. I highly recommend our listeners to go out. As Ian said, it's not an expensive book. But the more people who read it, maybe we'll get some good discussions going either on Twitter or over at gamesatwork.biz or at reconfigurebook.co.uk. Maybe there'll be a whole new universe created in this space. And one day we'll go to the bookstore. Amazon just opened their physical bookstore in Seattle. Yeah. And there'll be a whole rack of ePredator books.
Oh. Thank you, Matt. That's a dream that I now have to aim for.
No pressure, man. No pressure. Well, Ian, thank you very much. And everybody else, if you'll rate this episode, provide us your feedback over at gamesatwork.biz. Or if you really want to help us out, it would be great if you would go over to iTunes and give us a rating and a review. Reviews really help us. And let us know what you're thinking and what games you are playing at work. Thanks, everybody.
You've been listening to gamesatwork.biz, the podcast about gaming technology and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network and would like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue.
You can follow us on Twitter at gamesatwork_biz or at our website at gamesatwork.biz.